The first discs in Naxos's new cycle of Shostakovich symphonies with Vasily Petrenko and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra have received great acclaim. For each new release in the series, Edward Sexton will be talking to Petrenko about the works and his interpretation of them, beginning here with symphonies numbers 5, 9 and 11.
Vasily Petrenko, what are you most proud of having achieved in your first 3 years as principal conductor of the Royal Liverpool Phil?
The most proud I am about audience. We achieved 40% growth of audience. And hopefully this habit for the classical music will just increase and increase in Liverpool, with the help from everyone, with the help from local governments, with the help from British government, and the involvement of all good people of Northwest and all the proper scousers as well.
Let's talk about the orchestra. I know you're particularly proud of the work you've done with the string section, particularly with regard to Russian repertoire. Can you talk about that a little? Because it's a very specific sound.
I think the secret of the Russian orchestras, at least in the golden time of Soviet Union, has been that the music schools and conservatoires, they produced soloists. So everyone who studied in conservatoire pretends to be a soloist, especially the string players. And of course, very few of them been a soloist. Most of them been then later sitting in the orchestra. So basically, the best orchestras of the country consist of the soloists, which gives, first of all, the huge technical abilities, of course. Secondary, it gives the richness of the sound, because everyone feels like a soloist. There are also negative sides, because it's very difficult to get all the soloists together. Everyone have his or her own opinion about how to play the certain passage, and how to unify that all. It's another story. That's the dark side of the moon. But that's what has been a secret. And that's what you need to encourage all the people in orchestra. That's what I did in Liverpool.
So what have you actually said to them that will change the way they play?
I say to them that it's great that you listen to each other. It's absolutely fantastic, and that's what's necessary. Please watch even more. Where do we play exactly, in which part of the bow, what kind of articulation, where on the fingerboard, around the bridge. Watch out your left hand, how much vibrato. In fact, quite often I've been saying them, let's try to play less Tchaikovsky sound, so reduce your vibration a little bit, because otherwise it goes very waggy in a way. And that's been one part of speech. Another part being, but please feel as a soloist, even if you're somewhere in the middle or in the back of the second fiddles, you are part of the musical process. And even if you think that those few notes which you play in this bar is not important, it's not true.
Now, you are in the process of recording all the Shostakovich symphonies, which is a huge project. What's been your relationship with the symphonies, and why do you think they are such an important and unique achievement for our times?
Well, I think that, first of all, they've been in my life since I remember me. They've been played in St. Petersburg and regularly and every year. Even funny enough, they're still being appreciated, most of them, as a contemporary music in Russia. And of course the top hits like the 5th, 7th, 8th or 10th, they are well received and well attended. But when you put something less usual like 12 or 11 or 4...
Oh, really? In Russia?
Yeah. It might scare the audience a little bit.
What?
So, I can remember his music since the very beginning, and to be honest, it's the spirit of Leningrad, it's true spirit of Leningrad.
But it's also a chronicle, isn't it, of Soviet life, that extraordinary...
If talking about the historical context, I'm staying actually on a position about a bit more broad picture about his symphonies, because usually on the West is a lot of attention to the political side of it. While in Soviet Union and in Russia, it's been absolutely opposite. The most attention has been about structural side and about the musical side, neglecting the political because it's been not allowed for many, many years. I think, first of all, it's a picture of his life. The whole cycle, in my point of view, is a huge biopic about the life of an artist in the 20th century under the Soviet Union regime. And not only reflecting the political side or historical side, reflecting his own life as well. Family life, relations with other composers, relations with the music society, his relations with some great musicians like Slava Rostropovich, for instance. It's a history of the life of an artist.
See, some of us in the West wonder why he stayed in the Soviet Union when he was subjected to such humiliation on occasions.
Well, first of all, he's been very introverted human himself. He kept silence most of the time. And in fact, the silence quite often meant much more rather than he would say anything.
Yeah.
For him, what was important is to have a wife who will take care about the food and about laundry, to have a room with a table, not necessarily with a silence, but with a working table, like work desk, on which he can write the music. And the piano was not necessary. It's funny enough that the picture of Shostakovich on the piano composing music, it's not fake picture, it's once upon a time, but he quite never composed on the piano.
Did he compose in full score straight away? Like Mahler?
Yeah. Mm. And there are very, very few drafts. And the last thing which he was needed was hot water in the bathroom.
That's amazing. You said his silence spoke volumes, but also there were lots of coded subtexts in his pieces.
The scripts are famous.
Clearly these were deliberate, these messages he was sending out. Did he really expect audiences to decipher them and understand what he was trying to say, do you think?
I think he tried to write the pieces for the broad range of the classes and all broad range of the intellectuals.
Mm.
The first symphony, of course, it's a conservatoire finishing work, and that's what he had been written for a year. Then second and third symphony, he felt like he failed because it's been commissioned works for industrial concerts. And then came the fourth symphony, which been kind of laboratory in many ways.
Mm.
And that has links to most of the pieces.
Yes.
Later on.
Absolutely.
And then he found this style from the fifth, when he'd been able to put the music into the earth of the proletariat, basically. And in the same time, he'd been able to encode some things for the very little amount of his friends.
Hmm.
And for the intellectuals who knows this or that, he tried to speak from his heart most of the time. But because of the restrictions in what he could say, sometime it seems to me that he stopped himself of saying it openly, because otherwise he could have much bigger troubles, and he just encrypted them and put the things in a different way.
Better to have a voice than no voice at all. Yeah. And for the benefit of people who are new to the symphonies, sometimes what we hear is often the opposite in meaning to what.
There's been composers of 20th century, you know, starting from Mahler, actually. When you're listening to the symphonies, quite often it's extremely, I would say, celebrating music, which in fact covers a disaster behind it. And then you find this disaster much later. You find this terror later on. And the opposite, quite a sad music, but transfigurated.
Two discs have been released so far. Let's talk about those. If ever there was a make or break symphony, it was the Fifth Symphony. How seriously should we take his famous comment, a Soviet artist's creative reply to just criticism?
As usual, with a pinch of salt. From my point of view, I think he really tried to improve himself. He really found that the language on which he writing the symphonies are too complicated, because it's very limited amount of the people who can understand it by then. So he tried to simplify a little bit compared to the fourth.
Yes.
It simplified a lot. From other side, he still have this huge irony and grotesque in it. The heroic opening, for instance, have a very dark color. Even if you describe it as heroic, it's you clearly from the first bar you can see that it's a struggle.
Few composers had a greater sense of atmosphere in their music than Shostakovich, and few composers were able to create space like Shostakovich. And I think you achieved this wonderfully well in your recording of the Fifth, when we get to the second subject, and you know, there's this sense of a sort of weird calm comes over everything. A very beautiful melody arrives, but it's the sense of space.
Well, the melody by Bizet. Almost exact quote from Carmen. The story behind it is, of course, this love story about the woman with whom he fell in love, and then she married a Spanish communist and moved to Spain. Yeah. And in context, of course, it's kind of bird of hope, in a way, just flying over this big struggle in life. In the Fifth Symphony, there are so many things which are so interesting because of their relationship. For instance, the end of the slow movement, when it's a harp and celesta together. It's not exact quote, but it's very similar to the signals of the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio started to work at 6 in the morning. It started from National Anthem. But before National Anthem, just to tune everyone, you know, just to not shock at 6 o'clock in the morning with National Anthem, there have been a few clocks and clicks and the different tunes which sounded quite similar to this ending. And if you look into the Adagio, for instance, it's a picture, in my point of view, of the white night, kind of grey-white night, which ending at 6 o'clock in the morning with this. It's not a good night because that's already been a period when plenty of people have been taken to the camps, and this black, famous black car which came to the apartment, and then you never see the person again. And Shostakovich himself, he'd been packing every single evening. He'd been packing just emergency case for him. Yeah, there's been about 2 years when he'd been really waiting.
Mm.
It's not just an adagio, it's very intensive and very silent most of the time. But very intense.
Coming back to the first movement, there's a very particular way he has of brutalizing things that you've already heard, and very often turning them into war machines. Here is this goose-stepping quick march, which is really scary, actually. And
yeah, it's a bone crusher, one of them. He had plenty of them. It's anti-humanistic. And that's the effects, actually also linked to his mother, which he had quite often, this kind of grotesque march.
What about the symphony's close, Vasily? Jubilant or submissive? And I think you make it very clear indeed in your recording which it is. I mean, those repeated A's just are interminable, like someone driving something into your
head.
That's
a nail into your brain.
Right.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what the strings actually... I say to them in the recording that you need to hate this A's all the way through, and they really did by the end.
Yeah.
It's been a famous misprint brought to the West by Boozy and Hawkes. The original tempo indicated is quaver equal 184. While Boozy and Hawkes, who've been the only publisher in the West for many years, put the crotchet equal 184. So like double speed.
Just a slight difference, yeah.
Double speed. I don't know, was it kind of incidental misprint, or was it just recommended by some conductor who did that and said, you know, it's inappropriate in this space because the orchestra union probably say to him, you know, there's ace for many times, it's just too long, we don't need that, let's play it quicker and finish the concert earlier.
Isn't it interesting though how utterly different the piece sounds based on your decision of tempo?
I think that it's possible to play it with a quick and celebrative ending, but then one note, this top C from the trumpets, which not allows you to do it, in my point of view at least.
Okay.
It's just because it goes to this A, B, and then A, C as a huge achievement, and that's actually the key note of the whole symphony altogether. That's why I think it's more Boris Godunov beating on the wall.
And there's certainly more Boris to come in later symphonies as well. Symphony number 9, Vasily, was originally intended to be the third in his war trilogy, 7, 8, and 9.
Well, it's been kind of third in the war trilogy, I would say.
What happened, though? Because it wasn't what he started out to write, was it? He drafted a first movement, which...
It was. I think it was.
Do you?
I think it's his famous sense of humour. About three times he admitted that he would write the symphony about Lenin and glorify everything. That what happened before 6, that what happened before 9, and that as well what happened before 12. While 12 is about Lenin in a different aspect. And about 9 especially, he announced through the Pravda that I'm writing a symphony to glorify the victory of the Soviet Union.
So
in
he
the
sets
world.
Up this false expectation deliberately, yeah?
Absolutely. The memoirs of the musicians who've been listening to the symphony, and they listen to the live broadcast on the radio, and the feeling being that we came with great expectations, read this article about it, and been expecting that, you know, after 8th it will be resolution of the tragedy of the 8th, and then by the end, most of the memoirs said, we just got home in a silence. Simply because it clearly shows this dance on the bones. By the end of his life, Stalin started to see spies in all people around him. And the people on the lower levels, they also have seen all danger points around them, because it's been a very difficult time. After World War, even being victorious, there are a lot of problems in the country, all around, people dying, suffering, all things. There are also moments when the men from army came back to their villages, and they found that they're probably the only guy who survived for a whole village. So remaining villages just the females. And he really, there have been a lot of examples of the terrible behavior of the people. And the sins of the bureaucrats, he have got these huge bellies, while the other people just been dying from the sufferers. It's really a feeling that the country's in ruins.
Yeah. I suppose, in a way, the authorities had good reason to fear Shostakovich, because, you know, he was quite a successful subversive. In a piece like the Ninth Symphony, the humour is used very subversively, and nothing is as you expect it to be.
It's all absolutely peculiar world. If you, for instance, if you, by accident, you don't listen to this Largo.
Okay.
You just listen to the fourth movement.
Yeah.
It's all bluff and all laugh on the principles of the society. While this bassoon solo and cadenza and the cry, it gives you the key to understand what it is behind it.
But then he turns it into another practical joke, doesn't he? It's the bassoon. After this oration, he then twists the melody round and goes off
because,
on this rather jaunty...
Because he don't have a choice.
Yeah.
He can keep it for his half an hour of private life per day. But that's been one of his famous protective jokes, just to protect himself.
Yeah. It's funny, at the end of this piece, I always smile because as an outsider, it sounds like the Red Army Ensemble band has come in.
Yeah, there are all kind of things. It's absolutely crazy coda. One of the critics have opinion that that's us. You have this old vinyl gramophone, and then suddenly you press the wrong button, it's the wrong speed.
Yes.
And just all goes wrong up to self-destruction.
Absolutely. The 11th Symphony, Vasily, is my personal favourite among the symphonies. And I don't know whether it's because, as an outsider, I am moved by the thematic fabric of it. You're from Shostakovich's city.
Hmm.
What does it mean to you, this 11th?
It means a lot. In fact, this is the first time in Russian history when the people of the country and the citizens together declared their will. Because there have been an attempt in the 19th century, in 1825, when the December uprising, but there's been a uprising of the officers. While in 1905, the most of the people, they haven't been anywhere else rather than Russia. But they've been so upset by their life that they came to the Tsar peacefully with icons and with the Korubits, with all the symbols, to declare their will. And, of course, they found just a rapid fire on them, and there's been a lot of victims, first of all. I've been across the Palace Square many times because I've been studied in the school, which almost...
This is where the massacre took place,
And especially in the winter, it's from the very first opening bars, you can feel the atmosphere. It's exactly there. When I'm conducting this piece, I can see where they came and where have been based the shooters, the gunners, what happens here and there, how all this crowd tried to come and what's been the output of it.
In the snow. You see, but this is one of the criticisms that's been levelled at the piece over the years. I think only in recent years has it become regarded as a really important piece. A lot of the time when I was growing up, it was considered to be film music.
It's very personal for Shostakovich, very personal, because his father has been there, his grandfather has been a revolutionary too. So he's from the revolutionary family. And for him, I think it's been very important to show what really happened there.
I wanted to quote that wonderful line from the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, describing the songs in this piece as like white birds flying against a terrible black sky. It's a very direct but rather moving description, because the backdrop, which is very graphic...
It's all very graphic.
I
absolutely agree. It's very, very graphic. But as usual with Shostakovich, sometimes you see into the black and then it's not a black, but it's white.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this section, the massacre itself, is one of the most dramatic pieces of percussion writing in the whole of Shostakovich. This immense battery of percussion.
Rapid
absolutely.
Fire.
But another startling effect that Shostakovich, again, repeats again and again, is the dissolution of this huge sound into just one chord that's so barely there that you think it's silence that is being depicted.
That's echo.
Scary.
That's an echo. The Palace Square have a relatively good acoustic. Half of it is a Winter Palace, which is a straight building, just one wall. Another building is kind of angled to it, but it's a straight angle. And then it's a half a circle, which is the main headquarter of the Russian army.
So he heard this echo.
You can hear clearly
the tumult of this sound.
You can clearly hear when the shooting is finished. The shocking moment, I think, not only for the person who watched it, not for the watchers, but for participants, for the soldiers who just finished it. And only by then they realized what they had done.
One of the most memorable things in the symphony is that long cor anglais solo just before the coda in the finale, which is one of the key songs from the piece. Which song is it? Is it Bare Your Heads?
Take Your Hats
Take
Off.
Take Your Hats Off, yes. Yeah. And it, if ever a solo, and this again is true of all these great long wind solos in Shostakovich, they convey this great world weariness, solitude and desolation, and this one I think is particularly moving.
It's kind of, in my point of view, it's very linked to Alexander Nevsky by Prokofiev. An image of the woman who going through is basically through the bodies who's laying on the ground, probably trying to find her relatives. It's a traditional image in Russian philosophy as well of the woman who can walk on this terrible surface full of blood and dead bodies and everything, and keep her cleanness. So being basically white without any drop on the blood.
It's a great kind of maternal figure, isn't it?
It's, I think it's allusion of the Mother of Christ, basically. It's probably none of them are her relatives, but all of them are her children.
The end of the symphony is pure Boris Godunov. The ambivalence of the bells, major, minor.
Well,
do you let them ring out at the end? At the
well, you can hear it. You can hear it. The problem is, in my point of view, if you, at least this set which we had in Liverpool, if you let them sound, they sound for far too long. It's another half a minute, which you just can't keep. So what we did, because in a whole orchestra, the only instrument which is not involved in the last chord is harp. I've asked the harpist, because she said almost next to the bells, to gradually stop that, because it's four of them, so you can't stop it with two hands just by the percussionist. So a percussionist took two of them, gradually fading, and she took another two to fade it. And it actually made a very good effect, I think, by the end.